Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I am Tiziana Deering, and it is President's Day. And what ironic timing. The holiday that was inspired by Washington and Lincoln that embraces U.S. presidents this year falls just 2 days after the second impeachment trial of our last president, which closed with an acquittal on Saturday. So what comes next? An accountability for Donald Trump and on the agenda for President Joe Biden now. Massachusetts Congressman Jake Auchincloss has something to say about it. He is on the line now. Congressman Auchincloss, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you.
So I have to ask you, we last talked on the fourth Wednesday in January, and you pointed out that your first Wednesday in Congress was an insurrection, the second an impeachment, the third an inauguration. Last Wednesday, you watched an impeachment trial. What does it look like from where you sit today?
Well, I'm gravely disappointed, as I know many of my constituents are, with the Senate GOP failing to do their constitutional duty, really being too scared to do what was right. But we have paths forward, and I want to talk about 14th Amendment Section 3 and what Congress can still do to prohibit President Trump from running for office again. That's an issue of national security, but it's also about representing that nobody is above the law, that there will be consequences for inciting insurrection. We need to pass a joint resolution that lays out the facts of what happened on January 6th, the President Trump's role in it. And of course, the impeachment proceedings have made it easier to lay out those facts. And then concluding that the third section of the 14th Amendment disqualifies President Trump from holding office in the future. And then we also need to pass. Go ahead.
Well, I want to talk more about that. But before we do, can I please pick up on something else you just said? You expressed your disappointment there. And you have said that you expected the acquittal and were nevertheless disappointed. You also, in the last 48 hours, have called it political cowardice. And now you're talking about getting some things passed. And I do wonder what it's like to try to get work done with people you've labeled cowards, especially you're a former Marine. I imagine that word has particular meaning for you.
It does, and I don't use it lightly, and it brings me no pleasure to use it because I am sent to Congress in order to work with people with whom I disagree to get things done. That is there's a long and noble tradition behind vigorous disagreement on policy, and that's totally appropriate. It's what it means to live in a democracy, and I actually welcome that disagreement. I think it makes policy better in the long run. But there are guardrails of democracy beyond which we cannot go and beyond which behavior is unacceptable. And to watch these GOP senators and GOP members of the House who know that what they saw was wrong, who know that what they saw was unconstitutional and impeachable, and yet be too afraid of far-right extremism to take a stand, just really, it undermines confidence in the Constitution and the country.
So then what makes you think that you can get the 14th Amendment joint resolution done?
Well, it's a little bit of math and it's a little bit of politics. The math side of it is that to get this done would require a majority in the House, which we have, and a 60-vote supermajority in the Senate, which is three more than we got for the conviction vote, which is easier than the 10 more that would have been required in the Senate for conviction. So the math's a little bit easier. And then also politically, a censure has less political freight behind it than an impeachment and conviction would have. So it may be easier for those three GOP senators to vote in favor of that and to prohibit Trump from running for office in the future.
You know, I noted that there are varying legal interpretations about the 14th Amendment, whether it applies here, including one interpretation that says it doesn't mention the presidency, so it doesn't apply to the presidency. We just saw an acquittal that was based on a legal interpretation that's considered by at least some to be fringe constitutional law. So do you think you can get agreement on the applicability of the 14th Amendment here to start this process?
Couple of threads in there. So as you said, the argument that the president was not impeachable because he's no longer in office is just absurd. And I think every serious constitutional scholar recognized that it was absurd. And it was a very flimsy shield for senators who were too afraid to do what was right. The 14th Amendment, Section 3, absolutely applies to the president because it applies to anybody who takes an oath to the Constitution. And as we all saw with Joe Biden's inauguration a couple weeks ago, you, of course, take an oath to the Constitution to become president of the United States. So it applies to a president of the United States. Now, having said that, it almost certainly would be challenged in court by the Trump camp. And so this would require both Congress to pass a resolution finding that President Trump violated Section 3, or violated the 14th Amendment, excuse me. And then also it would require the federal judiciary to step in and protect the Constitution as well. I'll add that there is a second parallel track here for Congress, which is to pass targeted enforcement legislation, which would contain the same set of facts about how President Trump violated the 14th Amendment by inciting insurrection, and then also permitting the Attorney General to bring a court action to obtain a judgment that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment bars President Trump from holding office in the future. And that is not inconsistent with the first action, it's just more targeted. And this is a good opportunity for me to call out here an organization called Protect Democracy. It can be found at protectdemocracy.org. I'm proud to say that they're based in my district, and they are a group of former executive branch attorneys who are committed to upholding the Constitution and who have done really terrific work on the 14th Amendment for listeners who are interested.
So this would all be with an eye towards keeping the president from running for office again. I don't like to pick up on trolling, but I do have to note the Boston Herald's reporting that Steve Bannon spoke to a group of Boston Republicans over the weekend and laid out a vision where the former president runs for Congress in 2022, runs for Speaker, then launches impeachment proceedings against the current president, Joe Biden, for stealing the election. And then that's a path to running again in 2024. Is that trolling, or are you concerned that if you can't get this done, that's where the Republican Party is going to go?
I mean, I'm not going to engage with Steve Bannon's just performative extremism. What I want to be very clear about, though, is that these efforts are not political. They're constitutional in nature. And what I mean by that is I'm not invoking the 14th Amendment here because I disagree with President Trump's policies. I do. I think he was a terrible president. But that's not a constitutional reason to prohibit someone from running for office again. This is about his violation of the Constitution, specifically his incitement of insurrection. And if we as a country are going to be a government of laws, then we need to establish the precedent that anybody, even the president of the United States, is subject to that law and that there are consequences for breaking it.
So you, over the last 48 hours, seem to have really been holding two things in two hands. One is this 14th Amendment. The other is your focus on what you have repeatedly termed crushing the coronavirus. One of the concerns about going through another Senate impeachment trial was potentially derailing the Biden administration's agenda, which includes this nearly $2 trillion bill. Trial's over. Is it time for the bill? Can it get done? Where is your sense of urgency? Not like it's missing, but what do you feel most urgent about there? And what happens next?
Well, Congress can absolutely do two things at once. We can hold the worst president in history accountable for violating the Constitution, and we can handle the greatest natural disaster in a century. I spent all last week on committee hearings about this American Rescue Plan, making sure that we were getting money for vaccine production, for reopening the schools, for helping restaurants that are in dire straits. So Americans should absolutely expect and even demand that Congress do two things at once right now. Certainly most American families have been. I think we need to make handling COVID the absolute priority of the foreseeable future. Until this is behind us, this has to be priority number 1A. I know it's President Biden's priority. It's certainly my priority. Insofar as there is any reservoir of this virus anywhere in the world, it's a threat for a new variant that is not addressable by the existing vaccinations, and thereby it's a ticking time bomb for another pandemic. So shots in arms needs to be the order of the day for so long as there are unvaccinated populations anywhere.
Do you think kids should be in person in schools now? You mentioned getting Americans back in schools.
One of the great tragedies of this pandemic has been the loss of in-person learning. We know that remote learning is not adequately meeting the needs of students, parents, or teachers. We know that there has been disproportionate impact on low-income families, on communities of color, in terms of how far behind kids have fallen in literacy and numeracy and pro-sociality. It's a tragedy. And getting kids back to in-person learning is a matter of education. It's a matter of equity. It's a matter of the economy. We need to do that as soon as safely possible. I've been working very hard in the district to expand surveillance testing to that end. We need to upgrade HVAC in the schools. We need to vaccinate teachers, and we need to get kids back into seats ASAP.
So the Commonwealth is supporting this, or the Baker administration is supporting this bill, supporting another $1.9 trillion. There was Boston Globe reporting that actually the Commonwealth hasn't spent a significant chunk of the money we already have. I'm sure that's true for other states as well. Some $1 billion in federal stimulus cash here in Massachusetts is not yet spent. Given concerns about deficit spending, that if you spend $2 trillion here, what do you do with infrastructure later, for example? How do you balance that with the idea that the Commonwealth hasn't even spent yet what it's got?
Well, there's a deep reservoir of need. The cost of expanding educational programming to make up for what has been lost, of upgrades to HVAC, of testing for students and teachers for the near future, all of this costs real money, and all of this requires federal relief. And let's also keep in mind that local and state budgets are lagging indicators of recessions and tough times. So FY 2021, 2022 are likely going to be even tougher than the previous fiscal year was, and they're going to need that federal support. I'm a strong supporter of making this federal relief relatively elastic in how it can be used. I think states and cities and nonprofits and families and businesses are better judges of how they can use the money than the federal government is. And so I have no problem with it being fungible across time and across uses, but we know there's going to be a reservoir of need, and we need to get that relief to people ASAP.
So you're comfortable with the size, the timing, the pace of what's being proposed, despite concerns about how it's going to affect the economy and the fact that there might be the need for it to follow the Democratic agenda, big spending in the future on things like infrastructure, green energy.
We need to go big and go fast. There is the acute need for money to increase vaccination supply and vaccination distribution. And every hour that we are not spending money on that is potentially lost time in this race between vaccinations and variants. And then we know that there is the need for these dollars from all the participants in the economy right now. And I have great confidence that it's going to be spent in ways that are going to prevent scarring of the labor force by keeping people out of work, and ways that improve our productivity and allow us to rebound faster in the next six months to a year.
I know you've been very focused on the logistics of getting more vaccines out, produced and distributed. When do you think we're going to see a point of equilibrium where the supply can meet the demand?
I think it's going to be getting better and better over the spring and the summer. We're already seeing it get better under President Biden's leadership over the last few weeks here. The key is going to be not just using the Defense Production Act to produce more of the kind of complementary supplies to vaccinations, but it's also going to be approving new vaccinations and then catalyzing the partnerships within industry between those companies that have manufacturing bandwidth but no vaccine and those companies that have vaccines but not enough manufacturing bandwidth. If we can do those two things, approve more vaccines, get them online, and then have companies kind of pitch in to help with manufacturing, even if they don't have a vaccine themselves, we're going to have a lot of vaccinations over the course of the next 12 months, and we're going to need them all because, like I said, we cannot allow any reservoirs of this virus to be existing anywhere in the world, or it's a threat to all of us.
Okay, so with that in mind, when do you think your constituents will live a life that is not completely dominated by this pandemic? Is there some time frame in your head where you see that light?
So I think of it less in terms of a generic back to normal and more sort of sector by sector. And I can say that I am absolutely committed and focused on full in-person learning by September and significant and substantive improvements this spring as well. I don't want to make it seem like we're going to stay on the status quo right now. But by September, by the next school year, every kid full-time in-person learning, I think, just needs to be the rallying cry. And so much of the rest of the economy is predicated on that being realizable.
All right. That is Congressman Jake Auchincloss, who represents the 4th Massachusetts District. Thanks for coming back to the show, Congressman.
It's a pleasure to be here.